When you think of faith, what do you think of? What comes to your mind? When I say faith, you have faith. Do you have faith? I'm going to start here today. I'm going to challenge your belief about what faith is a little bit today and see if we can't refine our understanding of what faith is. I'm going to turn over to begin here at Luke chapter 17 and ask you a question about this. Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17, verses 5 and 6. And the apostles said to the Lord, increase our faith. Great. Okay. We have a context. Increase our faith. And so what does Christ say? He said, so the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say this to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. Do you have that kind of faith? Is that what faith is to you? I think that's a very interesting question. Is this faith? And when you think of faith, is this what you think of? Let me make this a little bit more clear in terms of the context of such a question. Do you know what Christ is saying when he says what he is saying here in actual reality? He's saying, take this mulberry bush. Where does it grow? On land or in the sea? It grows on the land. He says, I want you, if you had faith, you could command this mulberry bush, which grows on land, you could command that it would be transplanted from the land, transform its very nature to be planted in the sea where it would then flourish. It currently flourishes and blossoms and blooms on the land. If you had faith of a mustard seed, you could command that it would be moved to the sea and that it would change its very nature, and now in the sea it would flourish. Do you have that kind of faith? Is that what faith is? This is the challenge I want us to go through to get together today, is to analyze, then what is faith? If that's not what faith means, can you do that? I can't do that. I'll admit, I haven't tried. But I'm confident that I could not command a mulberry tree to change its very nature, and it's not because I don't lack faith. There's something here that Christ is trying to convey to us, which is misunderstood at a very light reading. This is not what he's describing as faith itself. This is the end result of the product of faith. And I'm going to help you to see what I mean by that in this message today. We're human beings. I want you to make sure that you're okay with this idea. We're human beings. Do you think God intended that we should be able to, each and every one of us, command trees that would grow on the ground to move into the sea, or to command things that are in the sea and which flourish to now go on to the ground and now flourish? And if all of us had that ability, what kind of chaos would exist? Like, it, you know, brings to me the idea of if you could move this mountain. Well, I don't want that mountain moved, maybe. But maybe somebody else does. And so now somebody's moving a mountain that I don't want moved. Maybe I got to move it back. Like, this is not what God intended for us to be doing. This is why we know that this isn't what actual faith in the practical sense is. It can't be that. Or we're all moving each other's stuff around. And I don't think that's exactly what he meant by that. Okay. I want to talk about what is real faith. Practical faith. Everyday faith. What the Bible in some ways describes as living faith. And I want to walk through three elements of faith today. So the first element I want you to make a note of, or I want to discuss with you, is belief. Now, What you may not really fully realize, unless you do a deep dive, is that the Bible oftentimes uses the terms faith and belief interchangeably. And that can make them confusing to understand, well, what is faith? If I read certain scriptures and it says faith is dot, 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 or this is faith, or it uses the word faith, and I'm reading it in context, and it's like, but that doesn't make sense. Or I read the word belief, and maybe it makes sense or maybe it doesn't. But it's because the authors, the translators, oftentimes will translate the same word two different ways. And so it makes it more confusing to understand what is really being said here. So I want to start with the term belief. What is belief? It is sometimes translated as faith, but belief is not faith. It's an element of faith, and I'm going to show you that. The dictionary, I use Merriam-Webster's online dictionary, has three definitions. I'll give these to you, and you can take from them what you think is relevant. But the first definition is a state. So we're talking specifically now is what is belief? A state or habit of mind in which trust or confidence is placed in some person or thing. You believe in someone. I believe in, you know, you might believe in your kids out on the football field or something. I believe in you. What does that mean? Number two, something that is accepted, considered to be true, or held as an opinion. Generally speaking, in the context of what I'll be talking about today, we're focused on this, pretty much on this element of what belief is. That which we hold to be true. Okay? So belief being that which we hold to be true. The third definition is conviction of the truth of some statement or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on examination of evidence. So a combination then a little bit of two and three. It's that which I hold to be true based on some amount of evidence. Belief. That's as good a definition of belief as I think we can have. I believe something to be true because I've analyzed it to some degree and I've come to a conclusion based on some amount of facts about that. And so I have a belief about something, okay? So I believe that I cannot fly. I've tried this numerous times as I've grown up and I have pretty well proved it to myself. I cannot fly. So I believe that about myself. And I have some evidence to support that belief. But did you know that beliefs are not static? Beliefs are not static. They can change. Let me read an article from the Indian Journal of Science called, the title of the article is The Biochemistry of Belief. Quoting from the article, and you can Google just exactly what I said and you'll find this article. It says, beliefs originate from what we hear and keep on hearing from others ever since we were children and even before that. The sources of beliefs include environment, events, knowledge, past experiences, visualization, and so forth. One of the biggest misconceptions people often harbor is that belief is a static intellectual concept. Nothing can be farther from the truth. Beliefs are a choice. We have the power to choose our beliefs. Our beliefs become our reality. This idea is very fundamental for us when it comes to our journey in the truth. You need to accept and understand that belief is a choice, first and foremost. Okay? You choose what you believe. Now, how you make that decision can vary. But the reality is that just because you believed A to be true yesterday does not mean that tomorrow, in the face of new evidence, you would come to believe that A is no longer true. You can change your beliefs. That's good news. God created our minds to be able to do that. Let me go on with this article. It says, the sensory inputs we receive from the environment undergo a filtering process as they travel across one or more synapses, ultimately reaching the area of higher processing, like the frontal lobes. There, the sensory information enters our conscious awareness. What portion of the sensory information enters is determined by our beliefs. Fortunately for us, receptors on the cell membranes are flexible. which can alter insensitivity and confirmation. In other words, even when we feel stuck emotionally, there is always a biochemical potential for change and possible growth. When we choose to change our thoughts, which are bursts of neurochemicals, we become open and receptive to other pieces of sensory information hitherto blocked by our beliefs. When we change our thinking, we change our beliefs. When we change our beliefs, we change our behaviors. I've said this term to you before that I'm going to say right now, and I'm going to give it a little bit more background for you today. Are you aware of what a cognitive dissonance is? So your brain is responsible for filtering this incredible amount of information, which is the world around us. There is so much information going into our brains that if God did not provide some mechanisms of control, you'd go insane. Your mind has to have ways of managing all of the information that's constantly coming at it. You have all of your senses, right? That's feeding you information constantly. All of your senses are feeding you information constantly. And your brain is trying to filter all that information and make it usable. How does it do that? Well, one of the ways that it does that is by creating processes of efficiency. Like, it can't run at 100% all the time or it will burn out. So there are efficiencies that the brain creates. One of those efficiencies is, I have two pieces of information that can't both be right, so you have to pick one. The brain won't let you believe both things when both things can't both be right. That's a cognitive dissonance. And so the brain puts you into a dissonance. And it says, by chemical reaction, resolve this. This is your job, resolve this right now. The brain doesn't care. It wants you to resolve it, so you have to. You can't believe that Santa Claus both exists and doesn't exist. You can't at the same time believe both things. Your brain says, sorry, you got to pick one. So you pick one. Kids oftentimes pick the former, adults pick the latter. I happen to know because of family members that keep Christmas. Boy, they want to believe in Santa Claus. And yet, as you become an adult, you realize, can there really be 500,000 Santa Clauses? I thought there was just one guy. And I honestly did that. There was this, I don't know if you've seen this thing, but years ago I found this engineer's analysis of what would happen if Santa Claus actually existed and could deliver all of the gifts in one night. It was like the rate of speed alone, he would have instantly evaporated on the first delivery. And so it's quite entertaining to read it. Like, it's just completely unbelievable. Anyway, cognitive dissonances are very real. So it's when you have two beliefs that both can't be true. You don't know them until you have a belief and then something else is presented to you that conflicts with that and you believe it. And then you're like, well, what do I believe? You have to choose. The dissonance won't let you go on. It's kind of like a hunger is a dissonance in the body. It says, I need food or I can't keep going, right? And so how do you resolve the hunger? You eat something. Your body is saying, make a decision. Eat. I don't care what. Just something. Okay, so that's another kind of dissonance that your body can go through. Now, here's the thing that's fun. You can resolve a dissonance rationally or irrationally because it's a choice. Belief is a choice. You know, think that through. Can you possibly, I'm not going to name any examples because I want you to just do it in your own minds. Can you possibly think of anything today that people are accepting as rational, which is completely irrational? I'm not going to say it out loud. Just trying to protect myself here. There are some things going on out there that people think are rational, which are, in some of our minds, completely irrational. Therefore, belief being a choice, you can resolve a dissonance rationally or irrationally. The choice is yours. Let me give you an example of how a dissonance works in real time. Let's look at a fun one here with Peter, as recorded by Matthew, the observer in this case. Matthew chapter 14. I think to myself, this would have been a fun one to watch. Matthew chapter 14, because you're going to watch somebody go through a cognitive dissonance in real time here. Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 through 31. So Matthew 14, 22, immediately Jesus made his disciples get into this boat and go before him to the other side, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now an evening had come. He was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by waves, for the wind was contrary. So we have a boat. We have the disciples in it. The wind's getting rough, and the seas are getting rough. Okay? What time is this? It says, now in the fourth watch of the night. So you know when that is? 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. is the fourth watch of the night. Okay? So this is pretty early in the morning. Most of us would like to be asleep at that time, except I'm guessing that if you're on a boat in very rough seas with the wind tossing your boat around, you might not be sleeping all that well. I don't know. I try to avoid that kind of circumstance. I'm just imagining it wouldn't be great. Okay, so they're in the fourth watch of the night when Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Anybody doubt that Jesus can walk on the sea? I don't. But we just accept that on face value, don't we? And when the disciples saw him, verse 26, and when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out for fear. Like, this is probably the first time Christ has manifested himself by walking on the sea in front of the disciples. They probably haven't seen this before. It might come across as a bit of a surprise. Somebody's walking on the sea. If you haven't seen Christ do something like that, you might be surprised by it. I don't think that's surprising to believe that. So they're trying to figure out what this could mean, right? And so they think, well, is it a ghost? Yeah, that's what it is. Okay. And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." Keep in mind, Christ later uses the same thing, "Be of good cheer." That's like his calming statement to the disciples. It's okay. It's going to be all right. "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." So Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." Makes me wonder, did you mean that? Because Christ says, okay, come. That's a command. Come to me and walk on the water. That's a command. And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Pretty amazing. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" What was the dissonance here for Peter? Is this Peter's first time on the water? What was his career? He's a fisherman. Pretty sure he knows that fish are in the water and people are in the boats. And that people can swim, but that takes effort. But under no circumstances does he believe that it is normal for a human being to walk on top of the water. So this is a known thing. He believes this, right? Any doubt about that? Of course not. He knows this. Like, you know that you can't exist without breathing. He knows you can't walk on water. And yet, he walked almost all the way over to Christ on the water. Until what? He's having to resolve this dissonance. Human beings cannot walk on the water. I'm walking on the water. You can't walk on the water, but I'm walking on the water, but you can't walk on the water. He became afraid. You know, how far out to sea are they? He's walking on the water. The boat's probably back there somewhere. We get a bit of a distance away, and now you're thinking about multiple layers of what this might look like. I'm on the water. The boat's way over there. We're not supposed to be able to walk on the water. A dissonance is definitely forming here. How did he resolve it? I can't walk on water. That's the resolution. Christ commanded him. He asked to be commanded. He obeyed the command. He walked almost all the way there. So Christ was proving to him, there's another choice to be made here in belief. but you chose the obvious. You resolved this thing with human reasoning. That's really what he did. He resolved it with human reasoning. Okay. This is what we do with our own cognitive dissonances. We can resolve them rationally. You know, it's interesting to me. Almost always, what would to Jesus Christ, what was the rational resolution of Peter's dissonance? It was to believe Christ, right? And stand there, right next to him, on the surface of the water, in the middle of a raging storm. To Christ, that would have been the rational choice. That's not the rational choice to the human mind. So to Christ, Peter's choice was irrational, wasn't it? To not believe me. To not just stand here with me and believe me. And so we think what God wants us to do is irrational, naturally. And we think what we want to do is what's rational. And Christ says it's the opposite of that. I would challenge you to go read Romans 12 and see what he has to say on that exact subject. What is rational to God and what is rational to man? They're not the same thing. Okay. Belief is a choice. Here's another biblical example. I like this example. Luke chapter 9. Belief is a choice. Let's go over to Luke chapter 9, verses 37 through 41. Luke 9, 37 to 41. Now it happened on the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, that a great multitude met him. Suddenly, a man from the multitude cried out, saying, "Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he is my only child. And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him. So I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Then Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." Okay, so I know for parents in this room, not hard to put yourself in this position. Something's wrong with your child. You believe it's a demon that's possessing and abusing your child. You've gone to what you believe to be the disciples of this great teacher. You've asked them to do something about this because you are helpless. I mean, I'm not surprised to find out, it would not be surprised to find out if all of us who have been parents haven't dealt with some kind of situation in which we felt helpless with regard to a circumstance we find our child in, whether that's illness or something else. It's not hard to imagine being helpless, where you are looking to someone else to help you fix this thing for this child you love so much. Okay? So here's a father who has no choices left. The disciples couldn't do it. And so here he is standing with the one being left that he thinks could do it. Maybe could do it. But what does he know about human beings? We have no power. The disciples have only confirmed this for him. They have no power to cast out this demon that's afflicting his son. So what do you think his formed belief is? This is not a problem man can solve. I believe that. This is his formed belief. Man cannot solve this. But yet, somebody has to. Maybe God could do that. Maybe, but how? How would I implore God to do this for me? Here's this man, Christ. Let's go over to Mark chapter 9, where it tells the story slightly differently, or adds some details. Mark chapter 9. Verses 21 to 24. Okay, so Christ here now asks the Father, how long has this been happening to him? And the Father says, from childhood. I don't know how old this kid is, but his dad's been putting up with this for a very long time. And often, now the Father adds to this, and often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. Can you imagine watching this happen to your child and you're helpless to do anything about it? But what does he say here? He says, but if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Who's he looking at? He's looking at the man, Jesus Christ. Is he something more than man, or is he just a man? Verse 23, so Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately, the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. He's in a dissonance. He wants to resolve this with the belief, right, that Christ can do what he says. But I've got a whole lot of baggage on this belief that says that no one can do this. It's going to take a miracle. Nothing short of a miracle can save my son. Notice that Christ said, if you can believe. Christ understands belief is a choice. Can you believe? And he says, because if you can believe, all things are possible to him who chooses to believe. This is why belief is such a fundamental aspect of faith. And the man says to Christ, help my unbelief, my weakness. I want to believe this desperately. So help me. Please help me with this. Okay, so faith requires belief in God. That's number one. Now, James, over in James chapter 2, reminds us that belief is not enough. It's essential, but it's not enough. James chapter 2 and verse 19. James 2:19. He says, you believe that there is one God. He's talking to converted Christians. You believe there is one God. You do well. Even the demons believe. And they tremble. So why are they demons? If belief were enough, why are they demons? They made a choice. Knowing who God is, they made a choice. It wasn't to follow God, though they believe in God, that He exists. They are spirit beings in the same realm as God. They know He exists, so they therefore believe. But they're still demons. Therefore, we have our second element of faith. It isn't just belief. It's belief followed by action. So we say we believe in God. What is the action that follows that, that proves our belief? These are required for faith. Both are required for faith. Let's go back here to verse 14. James chapter 2 still, verses 14 through 18, where James says, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith? Now, this is where this becomes confusing. James, so if you wanted to make a note, what's the best description of the book of James as a summary description? For me, I have labeled James the book of living faith. James's primary function here in this book is to describe what faith is, what real faith is. So, because he's trying to explain faith, the authors, not James, the authors are the ones who give us whether the word is faith or belief. But if you actually read it the way he intended it, let's read it the way he intends it. Verse 14, what does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he believes but does not have works? Can his beliefs save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, are they warmed and filled if you don't actually give them some food? He says, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also belief by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. You say you believe in God. What are the works in your life that validate what you just said? You believe. Because faith is belief combined with works. But someone will say, you have faith, you have belief, and I have works. Show me your beliefs without your works, and I will show you my beliefs by my works. This is what modern Christianity does not understand about what faith is. It requires action. You can say, I believe, but if your beliefs do not have the product of action that validates them, of what value is your statement, I believe? No evidence of it, apparently. How do we know that for certain that this is the connection he's trying to make? Okay, let's go down to James chapter 2, verse 19. Here the word is translated correctly. You believe that there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe. We're talking about belief. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that belief without works is dead? Here's going to go on to prove his point. Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac his son on the altar? Action, substantiating belief. Do you see that faith, verse 22, do you see that belief was working together with his works? And by works, belief was made perfect. His beliefs are established by his works. How do I know what he believes? His works match what he says he believes. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God. This is why I said what I said about how this word gets transposed and it gets used intermingled, right? Faith and belief being used the same way in the same sentence when it doesn't make sense unless it's belief first. As a description for what faith is combined with works. That's why it's tricky when you read this and you see faith, 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 and you're like, well, then this must be what faith is. And you're like, well, then how does this make sense in the context of works? Faith is belief plus works. Because it says, and the scripture is fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. Continuing on here, I want to see how far I need to go here, through 26. So verse 24 says, you see then that a man is justified by works and not by belief only. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so belief without works is dead also. This is what we need to understand if we really want to have a complete understanding of what faith is. Now, James wrote this epistle about the same time that the book of Hebrews was written. So let's go over to Hebrews chapter 11, just the previous book. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1, where we see where the same subject is being covered by the author of Hebrews. Hebrews 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. What is substance? It's real physical matter of which a person or thing consists and which has a tangible, solid presence. Substance. You can feel, touch, interact with a substance. Okay? So if something has substance to it, it's something that can be validated. So you might say, I'm trying to think of off the top of my head, something that has real substance to it. It might be an argument, actually. It's got real substance to it. Why? There might be a lot of elements to the argument that create a complete package that you can understand. That'd be a way to view that. What is evidence? It's defined as the available body of facts or information indicating whether a belief or proposition is true or valid. It's that upon which we would rely to say, I believe something. Evidence. So, for example, if I said I believe in God, and an attorney is hired to prosecute me for that, is he going to find any evidence? Because this is the same kind of word that's used in the legal context. Could you be convicted of your beliefs? Really convicted? Or do they only find sort of a circumstantial case? Like, I hope they could find a substantive case with a lot of evidence that could convict me of my beliefs. So faith is this. Faith is substance and evidence. It's belief with action that creates evidence and substance in your life. Do you see the connection? This is what real faith is. We believe in God, that which is unseen, and the hope of the resurrection into eternal life, which we have also not seen, but it is a promise of God, fulfilled only in the life of Christ, which is unwitnessed by us. So what is the substance that we actually believe this? What is the evidence someone could use to prosecute us that we do believe this? We're told in verse 6, we're still here in Hebrews chapter 11, so turn over to verse 6 because this is important for us to understand. Without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him, who believe and do. Belief combined with action, forming substance and evidence in your life of what you believe. This is faith. And without that faith, it's impossible to please God. Notice what each of the examples in Hebrews 11, which is called the Hall of Faith, the chapter of faith, the faithful of God. And notice what the significant characteristic that's recorded over and over and over again about these people. Verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice. Belief in God followed by action is faith. Verse 7. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things yet unseen and moved with godly fear, belief, prepared an ark, took action. Combined belief with action, faith for Noah. 17 through 19. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered, took action to sacrifice his son Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. What did Abraham conclude because of his belief? It says here that he concluded that God was able to raise Isaac up, even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense, meaning from the dead womb of Sarah. This is called faith. belief in God followed by action that substantiates that belief, combined they equal faith. So as you walk through each of the heroes of faith, the common thread among them is action. By faith, he did this or that. By faith, she did this or she did that. By faith, belief, action, faith. I'll add one more element to this. The third element of faith is trust. You can believe in God, you can take actions, but trust can unwind us. A lack of trust can unwind us if we're not careful. We have to trust God in the process. Let's go back to the example of Peter in Matthew 14 and be reminded of what happened to him. Matthew chapter 14 again. Verses 26 through 30. Verse 26. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out with fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered and said to him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that visual understanding that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. Fear undermined his trust. And beginning to sink, as the trust eroded, he began to sink and he cried out, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith." He let his trust erode his faith, his belief, followed by the action of just doing what Christ had said. But you know, even Abraham wasn't a perfect pillar of faith. Let's go back here to Genesis and notice something. None of us are going to be perfect in our journey. Abraham wasn't perfect in his journey either. But yet look what God said of him in the end, because he learned through his experiences to trust God. Early on, Abraham had some trust issues, and it affected his faith. I'm over here in Genesis chapter 12, verses 10 through 13. So Genesis 12, verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarai, his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance. Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me. But they will let you live." Where's the faith? Where's the belief followed by action? God will protect. Who did he put his trust in? Verse 13 says, "Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." Not because of God, because of your lie. Half-truth. It's a lie. So who did he place his trust in? It wasn't in God. It was in his wife. This isn't the first time either. Well, this is the first time, but it's not the only time. Go over to Genesis chapter 20. This is some time later. Time has gone by. You think Abraham's learned his lesson. I'm saying this because maybe we can be comforted by the fact that we're not perfect human beings either. We can throw rocks from our glass house, but Abraham can throw some back. But over here in Genesis chapter 20, we see that he hadn't quite learned the lesson yet. Verse 1 and 2, "And Abram journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. Now Abraham said of Sarah his wife," now she's Sarah, no longer Sarai. There's been some conversations with God in between. So he says of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister, And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Now notice the reason that Abraham gave for once again hiding his wife's relationship from Abimelech. Drop down to verse 9. Because if you're Abimelech, like, I just love how this is phrased. Really, because honestly, I'm a parent. And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, "What have you done to us? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done deeds to me that ought not to be done." Then Abimelech said to Abraham, my favorite quote of the Bible, "What did you have in view?" Like, what were you thinking? That's exactly what the question is. What were you thinking that you've done this thing? And Abraham's answer, and I hope he was sheepish when he said this, by the way. Abraham answered and said, "Because I thought," probably the start of the problem, "because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife." So who was he placing his trust and his faith in? Well, it wasn't God here. And he got called out in a great way, by the way. It's like worth talking to your kids about, walking them through this whole telling the truth thing. Because when you ask them, what were you thinking? You're not the first person to ask that question. Okay? Like every parent since Abimelech has probably asked that question of their kid. Once again, anyway, Abraham placed his trust not in God, but in the deception of his wife. But you know what's interesting is that this is still the earlier portion of Abraham's life. And what we have recorded for us in the New Testament is the statements of faith about him. This wonderful position that Abraham finds himself in the eyes of God, where it was his belief later convicted by his actions or proven by his actions when he was willing to sacrifice Isaac. And God said, "Now I know. Now I know." And his belief was accounted to him for righteousness. So what a wonderful turnaround. Meaning, hey, like I said, we all live in glass houses and we shouldn't be throwing stones at each other. Because none of us are perfect either. And I guarantee you some of us have fallen down in this whole faith thing. From time to time. This trust thing, I should say. From time to time. You know, Elijah was a man of great faith. And he did fantastic and marvelous things. For example, you read 1 Corinthians chapter 17, where Elijah caused the rain to stop for more than 3 years. He was fed by ravens. He saw a limitless jar of flour and a jug of oil and witnessed a widow's son resurrected. Remarkable things that he experienced and was a part of. And yet in 1 Kings 18, we read that God instructed him to cause fire to rain down on the water-soaked sacrifice before 450 prophets of Ahab and Jezebel, something also remarkable that Elijah's word and God did according to that word before him and all of those prophets. So you would think Elijah would be a pillar of faith, never wavering. Too much evidence of God in his life to ever worry or waver, right? Except 1 Kings 19. Verses 1 through 4. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done. So this follows the whole killing of the 450 prophets of Baal. And Ahab goes and he tattles to Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me." Gods, she's not talking about our Heavenly Father, by the way. This is her gods, the lowercase g. "Let the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as one of those or as one of them by tomorrow about this time." And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life. And went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die. And he said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." Where's his faith? He was afraid. Where was his trust in God? After everything he'd seen, We don't trust that God can protect us from Jezebel. Trust can erode faith. It can cause us to give up if we lose our trust in God. So we see that real faith requires belief in God, action based on those beliefs, and trust that God will do what he says he will do. We believe in God. We trust God. That doesn't mean we're the boss of God. He doesn't hide in one of our pockets. We get to pull him out anytime we want to and say, God, do this for me. Make this happen for me. I have such great faith. God would obviously respond, you ain't the boss of me. So again, if it became a legal issue for us, could we be convicted based on the evidence of our lives that what we say we believe is what we believe? Because that's what faith is. It's when our beliefs and our actions match. You know, we're all far more likely to live and die without ever having been tried in our faith like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's the most extreme thing I think any of us could possibly picture about being tried for what you say you believe. To be thrown in a fiery furnace that was so hot it killed one of the people that opened the door. Like, I'm going to be honest, I've never been tried like that. Probably you haven't either. I mean, we've had trials. Probably not that big, but we've all had trials. Does that mean that our faith can be shaken just because we haven't been put through that kind of a trial? I haven't been threatened to be thrown into a furnace burning that hot? That my faith still can't be challenged? Of course it can. It's an ongoing effort for us to continue to live our belief that the actions that we do in our lives support what we say we believe in. That's an ongoing challenge. Can our trust be undermined? Of course it can. Who hasn't watched and waited on God to answer a prayer without feeling a little unnerved by that in the process? We wait on God sometimes. Sometimes he doesn't answer yes right away. Will that unmove our faith? Can that shake our foundation? It can if we let it. Belief is a choice. Maybe I believe that God is the boss no matter what. And that even if he doesn't answer my prayer today, that doesn't mean he's ignoring me. Or that he might not answer it tomorrow. Or that if he answers no, that he doesn't have my best interest in mind. I believe that. I choose to believe that. And therefore, what should be the evidence of that is how I behave. What I do. What's amazing to me, if you think about all the examples of people that were given in the book of Hebrews, is that many of these people were just normal people living their lives. Same as you and I. And yet God says they have faith. And that without faith you cannot please me. They have faith, therefore they please me. Abel gave an excellent offering. Sarah conceived and bore Isaac. Abraham offered. Moses forsook. Rahab received and protected. Incredible feats of faith? Was it an incredible feat of faith for Rahab to protect the spies? I mean, in real time, seems more like she believed that these people had God of gods as their God. She took action because of that belief. Probably, in at least the way it's described for us, it doesn't seem that big of a deal. Like, look at the everyday things that you do. And what I hope you leave this message with is a confirmation that you have real faith if you've been living your beliefs. You have faith. God gives you credit for the faith you have. You don't have to be a super pillar Abraham in order for God to say you have faith and therefore please him. If you've got faith, you please God. That's the point. That's what faith is all about. Living your beliefs. Trust that God will do what he says. And believe him. Choose to believe God. And then let the actions of your life validate that. That that's who you are. That's what you believe. Because that's what faith is.